My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
James France is a 30-year veteran of the spirits industry in both Australia and abroad. In 2008, he founded the Sydney-based distribution business Vanguard Luxury Brands, with the objective of bringing the best brands to the best bars, liquor stores, restaurants, and hotels across Australia. He ultimately sold Vanguard in 2019 to Lion, the brewer, which simultaneously acquired a 50% stake in the biggest brand on Vanguard's roster, Four Pillars Gin, as we previously explored with Four Pillars co-founder Cam McKenzie on the show a few years ago now. After successfully managing that integration, James recently announced his departure from Vanguard. So I figured this was an appropriate juncture to invite him in for a chat about his experience distributing spirits over the last couple of decades, while the Australian industry was undergoing some massive changes. As you'll soon hear, while the Vanguard story had the happy outcome of a successful exit for James, as is invariably the case, there were plenty of challenges and costly failures along the way. Well, James France, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
My pleasure, James. Great to be here, actually.
Now, maybe if we just kind of go back to the beginning, I think people would be really interested to know, you know, what your entry was into the drinks industry. I believe you sort of had a background, you started out in marketing for Unilever and Philips Electronics. What made you decide to come to the dark side?
It was literally just an ad in the paper.
Yeah.
The actual newspaper, physical newspaper back in 1991. I was looking for a change and something that I was much more passionate about. And I applied for this job and got it. And it was a senior brand manager on Kahlua, which was huge back then. It's had a resurgence, obviously, in recent years. Everyone was drinking Kahlua and milk, and it was selling 120,000 9 litres back then.
What did the industry look like in Australia back then versus now?
Yeah, huge changes. There was no such thing as cocktail culture or, you know, craft spirits or anything like that. You know, it was all just big mainstream brands, and it was all pubs. There were no cocktail bars to speak of, really. So it was all very different. Jack Daniel's was still relatively small. It was kind of the super premium option back then, as well as that agave spirits were. You know, there was Cuervo and really not much else apart from El Toro as it was back then. So it was a very different, very mainstream sort of market back then.
But there must have been enough about it that kind of drew you in and, you know, got you interested in the drinks industry that you kind of stayed on. And I believe it, you know, it took you over to the US.
Definitely. One thing that I've always loved about this industry is it's the perfect blend of professional marketing and really good fun. So, like, Unilever was great, wonderful background, and I'm so glad I started there. In fact, I probably should have stayed longer. But I was finding it hard to be passionate about the product that I was working on, like, sort of supermarket brands of men's aftershave and stuff like that, you know. So that's why I love the liquor industry, because it is this great combination of fun and professionalism.
Was there any kind of discipline that you think you learnt from your time at Unilever, marketing discipline that was kind of applicable to the drinks industry, or was it a pretty different beast when you're talking about the different channels that you're operating in?
Well, obviously, yeah, as you say, the channels are totally different, but in terms of the groundwork, things like being able to prepare brand plans and conduct market research, those sorts of things, you know, which are hugely important, whatever industry you're working in, and whether the market research is just speaking to a bunch of bartender friends or where you're spending $5,000 per focus group or whatever it is these days, you know, those sorts of things. Those are all really great fundamentals that you can apply across all sorts of industries.
Tell me about your time in the US. It sounds like you had some pretty amazing experiences there that would have really given you some great exposure to the tequila industry in Mexico and agave generally.
Yes, well, that was a real highlight for me. So the first 3 years was with a company called the Paddington Corporation, which subsequently became Diageo, and I was working on J&B and some other brands there. And that was interesting, but then I was headhunted to go over to Remy USA, and they had just picked up this new brand of tequila called Don Julio, which wasn't in the States at that point. And they were looking to buy the brand back then, actually, but that obviously didn't end up happening. And so they brought me on. They said, look, you've got 4 months to bring this brand to market in the US. So that was just a watershed moment for me, because I'd worked on Cuervo a little bit in Australia, but I'd never been to Mexico. I was lucky enough to go to Mexico several times in the preparation for the launch of Don Julio, met Don Julio and his family on all of those occasions, had some hilarious long lunches with them and so on. And that just really ignited my passion for agave spirits or tequila back then. Mezcal wasn't something that I'd probably even heard of back in 1997. Yeah, it was great, a great moment for me.
I mean, agave spirits have been booming in the US for a few years now, but does this sort of predate that growth of agave in the States?
I'd say it was at the very early stages of that growth. I think by that stage, Ron Cooper had just started with Del Maguey, so that was very, very niche at that point. And then beyond that, mezcal was something that was just, it wasn't non-existent, but it certainly hadn't been commercialized. It was the early days of tequila growing. You know, we did see, I remember, lots of different brands coming into the US at that point, but it was nothing like it is now.
You ended up back in Australia, I think it was in 2000, which is obviously a few years before you launched Vanguard in 2008. And I was quite interested, you know, in doing my research just before this to sort of hear about how you built a spirits portfolio with McWilliams Wines, which is a bit of history that sort of predates my knowledge of the industry.
Yeah, that was it was interesting how that came about. So I came back to Australia and saw that there weren't really a lot of good spirit brands around, certainly ones that I'd seen in the States, or at least, you know, new brands. Obviously, Maxim was in place back then, carrying the Remy Cointreau brand, so I couldn't look at importing Don Julio. But I looked around and I contacted Herradura and said, you know, I'm interested in your brand. And they said, yeah, great, awesome. We're looking for an importer for Australia. You know, tell me about your company. And I said, I'm really just a guy with a laptop and nothing much else. Still that these days. They gave me the rights to that brand and I started distributing it myself and realized pretty quickly that it was just too hard to do by myself. And at the same time, I was consulting for McWilliams, who wanted to get into spirits at that point. So they said, look, you know the on-premise. We don't know that. We don't know spirits. Come on board. So I took Herradura and El Jimador with me into McWilliams, which was a really interesting thing. And then added Ketel One and Hendrick's to the portfolio as well. So we suddenly had a really nice little portfolio there. A lot of learnings came out of it, though. You know, like wine companies, generally speaking, and spirit companies, there's such different beasts, you know, different channels, different mindsets. You know, it never really, in my opinion, fit very well within a company like that. And then we started to lose the brands, unfortunately, for nothing to do with our fault. Herradura sold to Brown-Forman after, you know, 100 and something years of family ownership. Ketel One did the deal with Diageo for distribution. So we lost those brands, and I saw that, you know, the writing was probably on the wall with Hendrick's as well. So at that point, I decided to move on.
That was when you decided to go it alone with Vanguard. You mentioned before that you discovered that it was very hard doing it on your own. So were you doing it on your own when you launched Vanguard, or was it sort of more a case of like, you're doing it on your own, but with a bit more awareness of the market and what you were doing?
It's exactly that. Yeah. It's exactly that. So I started on my own because, you know, I'd said to my boss at McWilliams, I said, oh, there's a really big brand of tequila. You may not have heard of it, but it's called Patron, and they're looking for a new importer in Australia. And he said, oh, no, we're too busy with our wine business. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, this is too good an opportunity. So I left on very good terms. They gave me a magnum of Tattinger, which was very nice, and then started up Vanguard. And I pitched for the Patron brand, and they said, look, this is an amazing pitch. Your experience is fantastic, but we don't want to go with a startup. So there I was, I'd set up a company and I had no brands. And it was, as you said, my understanding of the industry was so much better by that point that I was confident that I could start up on my own. So it was just me for the first 3 years or so.
How hard was it finding the right brands that were willing to essentially take a little bit of a punt on a startup?
It was pretty hard, and I owe a lot of thanks to Niren Young, who was in New York at that time. I first met him when he was working at Bayswater Brasserie all of those years ago, and he was giving me a lot of steers on brands to look at and ones to avoid. You know, he said, James, well, if you're looking to start up, there's this gin called Aviation, and it's really cool because it's made by a bartender. And the first...
You should have bought into it.
I should have. I definitely should have. Yeah. And then he also warned me against a brand of tequila that I had in my portfolio from the outset. I remember the words. He said, I don't rate it. But I liked its provenance, and I liked the liquid, although the packaging was a bit out there. And it was one of the more spectacular failures of Vanguard, that tequila.
Which one was that?
Yeah, I think I can mention it now. It's called Trago.
Okay.
And Trago looked like a big perfume bottle, and everybody said that, but it was made by some of the Camarena family, so it had great credentials there. But it just, people ordered it once, and then they said, customers don't like the look of it on the back bar, I don't want to order it again. So I ended up having to lose quite a lot of money on that one. But
that's something that you would say that you kind of learnt as well early on, is that provenance and liquid quality are really important, but obviously packaging, you know, from that story is so crucial as well.
Yeah, huge learning there with that. It really is. You know, I was speaking to somebody a while ago who has a wine company, and he was dabbling in spirits, and he made all his judgments for the spirits that he stocked purely on blind tastings. And in my experience, that doesn't work. Packaging is enormously important, and the liquid quality, you've got to have good liquid quality. It's just the price of admission these days anyway. It's just a matter of how good it is. So it may be the best, but if the packaging is horrendous, then don't touch it.
What were some of the biggest wins that you had early on?
Well, certainly the biggest one to start with was St. Germain Elderflower Liqueur. Very lucky to pick up that brand. And, again, Rob Cooper, the owner of that brand, took a punt with me. I was still very small. I had Aviation, had Flor de Caña, Crawley's Syrups, and that was about it at that stage. And, of course, Vanguard still has two of those brands, which is wonderful. But St. Germain was one that really put Vanguard on the map in relative terms. It was the first listing I got with Dan Murphy's, got it into Duty Free, ALM took it on. So those were sort of three really big hurdles that brand helped me jump, which was terrific. And even though I lost the brand in early 2013 because Bacardi bought it, and that's an ongoing risk with a distributorship business, in any case, that gave us the momentum that we needed by that point.
You probably would have learned a few lessons with those experiences that you'd had in the past where you'd lost brands through no fault of your own, and maybe that was something that you were able to sort of have it front of mind when you're approaching contracts and all that kind of stuff.
Very much so. And in fact, in the early days, there were some brands that either didn't want to sign a DA or even stronger said, no, we will not sign a DA. And St. Germain was one of those. So if I was to start up again, I would say, well, there's no DA, then I'm not going to get involved. Because you need that DA for protection, really.
The distribution agreement?
Yes,
industry lingo. Why would you have done that? Just because you wanted the brand so badly that you thought it was, you know, you're going to have to take the risk, basically, at the time?
That's it, and also just lack of experience. And I just thought, okay, handshake agreement, that's fine, you know, and away we go.
Right, wow, it's kind of, looking back on that now, it's quite surprising, isn't it, that you were operating on that sort of basis?
That's right. I was with many brands, actually, until Lion came on board and understandably wanted their DAs for every single brand. Yeah, so it was a lot of work, but definitely it's very important to have a balanced distribution agreement, because if one's too heavily biased, if an agreement's too heavily biased, then that's a lose situation for everybody, I think. So it has to be balanced. And so, you know, without giving too much away, our DAs now say that, well, you know, if we're performing well and we're still meeting our targets, but you still want to get rid of us, then you have to compensate for that.
Yeah, for sure. What about, you know, you've kind of talked about how tricky it was convincing brands to go with an unproven startup, but was it difficult at that stage still, moving forward to 2008 when you started Vanguard, to find customers that were interested in working with you? I mean, talking more about the on-premise side of things.
I was really pleasantly surprised because I started Vanguard when I was sort of in my mid-40s, And I thought, geez, they're not going to want to talk to this old guy, you know, knocking on their door with a bunch of brands they've never heard of. But the bar industry is by nature a welcoming sort of industry. And they listened to what I had to say and the stories behind the brands, which were all wonderful stories of, you know, craftsmanship and so on. And so I found it actually, I think, easier than I thought it would be to sell these brands in, because a lot of them also had either heard about these brands or they were looking for a point of difference and didn't want to carry the mainstream brands.
It was still probably, though, 2008, before the real resurgence of cocktail bars in this country, and small bars, I think, were probably a few years away. You know, the small bar license in this state, for example, was probably still a few years away, though. Is that correct? And did those sorts of things, were they a real shot in the arm for your business?
They definitely were. And, thankfully Melbourne had the small bars going, but not in Sydney because of all those hurdles with licensing. And there was a saying back then that if you've got $500 and a sofa, you can open a bar. And that's what it was in Melbourne. And so you had all these great enthusiasts opening up these wonderful little bars and being really quite experimental even back then.
Those early years, you mentioned one high-profile failure, in your words. You know, how kind of difficult were those first few years? Were you pretty much bootstrapped and you probably couldn't have afforded to have too many failures like that?
No. It was one good thing about a failure is that it is a tax write-off, which is that's the only good thing probably apart from the learnings you get. But yeah, it was really hard because I couldn't afford anybody. So I was doing literally everything. From the importing, so I learned all about those logistical side of things and the financing and the sales and the marketing, absolutely everything. So if I didn't work on a particular day, then nothing got done. So it was really, really hard. And financially, all the way along, it was difficult because I didn't understand the cash flow requirements for your working capital when you've got a growing business. I just thought, great, you know, I'm growing, I'm making profit and my P&L looks good, but there's never any money in the bank, and it's because of the growth.
And, you know, you always need to buy more stock, I guess, because of, you know, to satisfy the market demand for the products.
That's right, yeah. The only time you actually make money you can take home is if the business plateaus.
Yeah. It's a funny concept, isn't it? What do you think are the most difficult aspects of distribution in Australia generally?
Ah, gee, there are lots of difficult sides of things. For a smaller company, when you're trying to get, you're up against big companies with big budgets and pouring deals and those sorts of things, that's very, very difficult. Especially the global companies have these, what they call transfer pricing, where they can basically sell their first pour spirits at what would be a loss to a normal person. But they can fund it through their global network. So you're up against those sorts of things. So that's very tough. Distribution is always a difficult side of things. You, no matter, you can have everything in line perfectly, wonderful brand, beautiful launch, and you've got interested customers. But then if your logistics partner stuffs up and misses a delivery or does a mispick, you know, and the customer doesn't have their tequila on a Friday afternoon, those sorts of things, you know, that's always difficult. And even to this day, I know that a lot of the Vanguard team, and I'd say people across the industry, are running around doing emergency deliveries on Friday afternoon for good clients because it's just too hard. You know, you can't let that customer go.
Now, I read a few years ago that Mr. Black, which Vanguard was distributing at the time, and Four Pillars were your biggest brands. So how significant was the rise of Australian craft spirits for Vanguard?
Very significant, especially for Four Pillars, who did just such a great job in creating consumer demand. So most of the brands that we had were in a situation where the trade loved them, but the consumers didn't know them at all. And those brands, to be fair, didn't have the budget to be able to create that demand or the know-how, whereas Four Pillars just did that brilliantly. So consumers would say, where is this stuff? I want to buy it. And when it made our job easier too.
You just sit there and wait for the phone to ring. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's right. Not quite that easy, but yes. That's it. But Four Pillars were really the pioneer of that. And Mr. Black as well, you know, they were really sort of brand-based entities rather than starting with a liquid and saying, how do we sell this?
You know, over the years that you've run Vanguard, I mean, are there any kind of trends that you were expecting to take off that you kind of banked on that didn't? Were you thinking like that? Were you kind of looking at what was happening over in the States, trying to predict what was going to happen in Australia in terms of the products that people were going to be interested in and looking for?
I think by and large, most of what we saw or and expected to see have happened or has happened. Probably the one thing that I still am surprised that hasn't taken off is aged rum. Bang for buck, it's just an amazingly good value, and the qualities of some of those aged rums out there are fantastic. But the Australian rum market is a very complex one, obviously dominated by Bundy and Bacardi, and that sort of skews the whole market stats, you know, in terms of what the market's really doing. So aged rum, I think, is an area that's definitely going to take off, and I'm surprised it hasn't yet. But otherwise, I think personally, some people may disagree, but I think in Australia, we're probably more led by what happens in the US than we are by what we see in Europe, with the exception of London. So, you know, something might be big in Paris or Rome or whatever, but it may never catch on here.
And the way that trend kind of finds its way here, is that just, you know, through people travelling over there and visiting the bars and then wanting to kind of recreate some of that stuff when they get back home?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of that. And of course, just all the online chat now that goes on about various brands and people that are associated with them. Tales of the Cocktail was definitely a good sort of, I suppose, epicentre for those sorts of trends and things like that. Aussie bartenders would go over there and see what was happening and bring that back. It'd be interesting to see how Tales is. I'm going to go this year again. Haven't been, obviously, for several years. So I'd be very keen to see what's happening over there this year.
What about agave spirits in Australia? You were very close to what was happening in that segment when you were over in the States and obviously investing in it early on with Vanguard, and it's been a big part of what Vanguard's done over the years is agave spirits. When did you start to feel that that category was getting traction here? Because from what I've been told anecdotally, it's really in strong growth now.
Yes, yeah, it sure is. Well, I saw that even as far back as Herradura in 2002 or whenever it was when I started importing that. I was really surprised at the interest in premium tequila way back then. So apart from the failure of my first tequila brand, all the other tequila brands and agave brands that we've had have done really, really well. So I think it's just going to keep going because people love the purity of those spirits, the provenance, the stories behind them, the people behind them, all of those sorts of things. So they're all in strong brand growth and they'll keep going that way, I think.
Lion announced its, you know, partial acquisition of Four Pillars in March 2019, and then the deal to acquire a stake in Vanguard came the following month. So how did all that transpire from your perspective?
Yeah, so it was interesting. It was in February 2018. I got an unusual call through somebody that worked at Vanguard, said, "Do you want to meet this guy from Lion?" And I'm just like, "Oh, yeah," I had no idea what that would be about. So I met this guy and he said, "Do you want to come in and have a chat?" I said, "Okay." So ultimately they said, "Look, would you be interested in selling the business?" And I gave it some thought and said yes. And they said, "By the way, we're looking at your books. We see that by far your biggest brand is this Australian brand, Four Pillars Gin. Would you be interested in them having a discussion?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." So I connected them. So then they met with the Four Pillars founders, the three of them, and agreed that that was a go as well. So basically, Four Pillars came about because they were looking at Vanguard's numbers and realized, I don't think they knew what a big brand Four Pillars was. And so it went Vanguard, then Four Pillars, and then the discussions were all supposed to happen and the announcement all on the one day of both acquisitions or both partial acquisitions. And there were just some legal hurdles at our side that slowed things down. But it was ideally supposed to be on the same day.
Were you surprised that it was a brewer that had come knocking on your door?
Yeah, look, I was, and as you know, Lion had worked with Bacardi in the past, and I said to them, you know, a few things that, like, if this does go ahead, it cannot be absorbed into the beer business, you know. Let those guys keep specialising in what they do so well, and then just keep spirits separate. And they said, yeah, absolutely, we're not going to merge the two businesses into one. It'll always be its own sort of thing. But they just saw a lot of growth in spirits. They said, you know, look, we see the numbers come in. We haven't got any skin in the game and we think that we can take your business and turbocharge it.
How has that gone? You know, that was 3 or 4 years ago now, and you've recently announced that you're retiring and moving on from Vanguard. So tell us about sort of how the last few years have gone as part of Lion.
It's been never a dull moment. They've always been really good to me at every step along the way, I must say. You know, there was a lot of pressure there, though, in that certainly in the, after the first tranche was sold, a lot of pressure to hit certain numbers and so on, which I'm sort of embarrassed to say at Vanguard, we never had targets before. We would just go there and sell, and the business kept growing 30, 40, 50% year on year. So we didn't have targets. Suddenly we had targets to achieve, and it all became very grown up. But no, look, it's gone well. You know, they brought a lot of really skilled people into the business, especially in the sales side of things, and they achieved things that there's no way we could have achieved. And Four Pillars was becoming more demanding as they were growing, as were other brands. It's an interesting thing. Like in the early days, everybody was just happy to be on board. But as the brands start to grow, they do get more demanding.
And what does that look like? Like demanding in terms of they want more sales, or they want, yeah, what are they looking for?
Yeah, so they...
I mean, obviously they want more sales.
They do. Yeah, they want more sales. Everybody wants more focus as well, of course. That's just an always or a common situation, always is the case there. So they want more growth, more focus. They're willing to invest more as well. So it's just adding more and more to the whole mix to get a bigger outcome.
Do you think it'd be possible to do what you've done if you were starting out now, you know, launching a Vanguard in this market now with access to all the amazing brands that there are out there in a very different bar industry as well? Do you think you could do what you've done, or would it would be harder or easier?
It's a lot more competitive now.
Yeah.
You know, back when I started in 2008, the big companies didn't really even focus on the small bars very much, you know. But now they see, obviously, that they're places where opinions are formed and so on. So that's a big focus for them. So it would be a lot more competitive now, up against big companies with really nice brands too. So it's not just big companies with big brands that they're trying to make look small. You know, they actually have genuinely very good brands now. So it would be a lot harder. But there is, I think, still room out there for another similar company.
Well, James, what are the next few years hold for you? You mentioned that you're off to Tails this year, so obviously not completely letting go of the industry, but it'll be nice to be there, you know, in a leisure capacity rather than on business, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking forward to that side of it because it used to be pretty intense. I'd have, you know, 6 or 7 meetings with brand partners every day on top of everything else. So it was this time it's just in a capacity of socialising as well as just, you know, keeping my network going. I do want to stay in the industry. I don't plan to set up another distributing company for reasons we've discussed.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what that's going to look like at this stage. It could be, as I half-jokingly said, opening up a dog-friendly bar. Sadly, the name Sit and Stay is taken, as is Good Boy and Very Good Boy. But, so I'm toying with that idea, but friends of mine who know all about bars, which I don't, they all just say don't do it.
Yeah. I always think that I would probably turn out to like the idea of opening a bar a lot more than the reality of how hard it would actually be.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think that's the issue there. So there are those sorts of things that some way staying in the industry would be great if I can, because I've got not only lots of experience, but so many really good friends from around the world, and I'd like to stay in touch with them. On other side of things, completely unrelated, a few people have said I should publish a book of dad jokes. Whether that'll happen or not, I don't know, but nothing's off the table at this stage.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on, you know, on the exit and what you've achieved with Vanguard.
Thank you very much, James.